Hi, this is Dave. We've had some problems getting in the line. I have Emily on another line. Let's go to this one. Would you hold on, please? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, hold on for just a moment.
Okay.
Hi, this is Dave. Sorry about the confusion. The line didn't work, and I made direct contact with them. I think they repaired it. Let's begin, and we'll just do an abbreviated discussion at the beginning. Emily, I know you're here. Would you bring us up to date? Any wins or progress notes or anything from last time?
I was doing the workbook stuff, and I caught a cold. I'm a little sick, so... I can go pull it up on my computer. Did you want us to discuss?
No, just whatever, anything you would like to discuss, anything to clarify or ask or discuss about any of the material from last time or from the curriculum.
I did have a question, but let me find it. You could ask someone else real quick if you...
Okay, who else is here?
Aunt Paula.
Paula, welcome.
Paula.
How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, David.
Bring us up to date for you. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I read through all the curriculum with two modules, and one of the things that was very good for me to do the exercise was the ideal clarification and exercise, and also the needs.
Yeah, maybe you can go over that part.
That's exactly what I'm going to be talking about today.
Okay,
we're going
perfect.
To do the first three steps of the roadmap today.
Excellent.
Okay. I tell you what, why don't I go ahead and get started on that, and then we'll have more time to discuss at the end in case there are any questions. Paula, was there anything else?
Well, I read through the two models, and... I'm a little bit stuck about my story, you know. I think I have a title for my story, but I didn't go further than this. And this makes me a little bit too confused, you know, because I lack of inspiration or something, you know. But as we're going to move step by step, I think I'll get over this.
Okay, let's come back to that at the end of this discussion, and after going over the first three steps, maybe it will begin to make a little bit more sense. Okay.
Okay.
All right, I'm
okay.
Going to keep an open line, so if there's a clarification or brief question, feel free to interrupt me, and otherwise I'll save some time at the end. Now, I'd ask you to manage the background noise. I hear shuffling.
Yeah,
paper,
I can't hear.
So
yeah.
If there's any background noise, go ahead and mute *6, and then come back when you're ready to talk. So we're going to be talking, we've already discussed the power of story and the concept of writing a new story. Now we're going to look closely at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change step by step. And the steps are simple but not necessarily easy. The actual implementation of the ideas can be difficult because it requires us to change the way we think about our lives. For example, breaking bad or outdated habits, just simply departing from a comfort zone. Developing new ideas, the discomfort of the unknown, and remaining disciplined over the long haul. So in this seminar, we're going to examine the first three steps of the roadmap process to create a new story. And remember, the roadmap is the acronym for the seven steps to deconstruct the process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new one. So the first three steps that we're going to look at are recognize authorship, own your story, and assess the plot and storylines. First, just a word about operating systems. You're aware of how computers have operating systems. Within the hardware comprising the programs is a complex system of software that contains instructions, protocols, and couplings that enable the system to function smoothly. Your life story has an internal operating system with a set of beliefs and assumptions, your blueprint about how life should be, that determines your behavior, We're about to deconstruct that system in order to study it, understand it, and for you to decide where it may need editing or rewriting or just simply updating. So first step, recognize authorship of your life story. And remember this premise. Every moment we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Everything we do is a choice. Every day begins a fresh page. The dramas of everyday life don't simply affect us, they're created by us. Yet so often the story closest to us, our own, may be the most difficult to know. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past to end an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. So how can we tell our life stories to ourselves to know what to keep and what to change? Now, your clients will probably recognize that they author their own stories, but as you listen, you'll hear a belief or assumption that ghostwrites a story that's limiting. I'll give you an example in a minute of an elephant who's an elephant in every way except for one little belief. So there are four principles in recognizing authorship. Principle one, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and results in life. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. Here's an example. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined in a small space. The trainer simply ties a rope around its leg and stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will initially try to break the rope, but the rope is strong and it can't. The baby elephant stays then in the area determined by the length of rope. Now, fast forward, the elephant grows to a mammoth adult size, 6 to 7 tons. It could easily break the rope, but it doesn't, because earlier as a baby, it couldn't. This huge elephant is constrained by the assumption based on earlier experiences. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that determines the behavior. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With this same belief, you'll continue to have the same result. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Principle two, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Our possibilities are always a manifestation of what we allow ourselves to consider. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, register, and process. We construct our storylines from these premises. So we have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus to assess how well they work in present time. And we don't get what we want, we get what we expect. We always make our beliefs come true. For example, if you believe no one will love you, you're going to interpret behavior and perceive responses in that way and act so that you won't be lovable or will block someone from experiencing intimacy with you. You act in such a way to teach people how to respond to you. This actualizes your beliefs and validate your assumptions. Also, kind of as a sidebar here, select carefully the people you spend time with. You are the average of the 5 people you are around the most. Do you like the results? Are they kind, successful, disciplined, achievers? One oversimplified version, are they winners or losers? Choose your friends and colleagues well. It makes a difference. We'll return to that at a later time. Third principle, a new story can only occur by living in the present moment. This is one principle that distinguishes coaching, the focus on now and next. For example, social scientists discovered that when you measure people's intentions, you affect their behavior. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer. When you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, do you intend to buy a new car? The question increased purchase rates over the next three-month period by 35%. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking if people intend to eat certain foods, to diet, to exercise. In the basic coaching model, the final step of each session is to frame an action plan for the next week that the client intends, commits to do. Principle 4, our minds seek closure and infer causality whether or not it's accurate. A number of research findings illustrate that we find something to make sense of whatever we perceive, even if it's not cause and effect. These research findings suggest that we can be unaware of the reasons that we do what we do, but when asked for a reason, readily give one. For example, a series of recent studies by Dr. Dan Gilbert at Harvard showed volunteers words flashed on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. This was such a short time they were unaware of the words that were shown and couldn't even pick them out or guess from a multiple choice. In other words, this was subliminal programming. Yet they were influenced by the words. When the word hostile was flashed, volunteers would judge others more negatively for a period of about 45 minutes after the word was flashed. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers would walk more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, volunteers would perform less well on tests. Now, these volunteers were later asked why they judged or walked or scored the way they did, and first, they denied it. They did not believe that they responded any differently based on these words. Then, when they were shown the video of the flash on the screen and shown the video of how, for example, they walked more slowly after the word elderly was flashed, they would come up with some reason. Well, you know, I was a little bit tired when I did the test, or I haven't been sleeping well, or I was jet lagged. Each was unaware of the fact that they were falsely attributing cause and effect. These findings demonstrate how our minds bring closure and how our brains end any dissonance by finding a causal explanation. Whether or not it's accurate, it brings closure. So, to create a complete story infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness. Complete trumps accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure without ownership or growth. A finish without an ending. So, this exercise in step one in the workbook, page 1.9, recognize authorship of your story. I would highlight that as something that I think would be helpful because the self-quizzes focus on major areas like needs, ideals, relationships, career, identity. Here's an example of recognizing authorship. A woman wrote me after reading my book, Destiny, An Uncommon Journey. It's an allegory of self-development with Destiny the ship undergoing transformation inside and outside. She said, "That could be a profile of my life. I'm sure a lot of other people experience the same thing. I don't want to relive this pattern over and over again. There seems to be this circuitry that I keep entering. Destiny had to trust in order to learn. When will I learn to trust? I keep peeling back more layers. How many layers to these distortions are there?" She elaborated about how frustrating therapy had been for several years with different therapists. I wrote back the following response. "We each have a personal story with a plot and storyline. Our beliefs ghostwrite that story. When you peel back all the layers of the onion, what's left is not a pure, unadulterated onion, but nothing, since you've destroyed the object of the quest. Instead of the model of layers going deeper to discover the next layer, consider generating a new story, going forward rather than backward. Looking at possibilities instead of problems. You can even assess when you're rewriting an old story and plagiarizing an earlier version of yourself. Then you can edit the repeating storyline or simply create a new one." She decided to work together in mentor coaching for a few months to create a new story. She now writes stories for a major U.S. publication and is working on a second screenplay. She asked me if I would be in the audience when she was nominated for an Academy Award. Step two, own your story. And here I'd especially highlight you looking at beginning page 1.13, Assumptions and Motivations Constructing Storylines. Now, from an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and then how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the million bits of data that we process daily, like a new diet or a health club membership, will likely not have an impact unless you change the software. As we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation that I think will be useful. And this is also in the outline. This is all in the outline. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. Some examples of empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to let my work. I'm sorry, was there a question? You might want to mute if you have paper or background noise. Limiting beliefs can also influence reality and behavior. Limiting beliefs have an effect emotionally and physically. For example, I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. My opinion doesn't matter. Any statement like that is immediately a coachable moment because these are storylines. These are statements that someone is writing that reflect a passivity or a resignation about the lack of possibility. The way you figure out how to adopt or to really adapt, actually, or survive is usually the way you continue to do that. Your first survival strategy usually becomes your favorite, but favorite even implies a choice. First, you have to experience it as a choice rather than just the way things are. Notice that these examples include a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. A specific example, we're in a unique position as coaches to observe patterns. The brain seeks patterns. Metaphors and narratives become brain structures. One example, attachment patterns. And this is something that we experience from early on in our lives. I will send you each a white paper on attachment patterns that I think might be useful. Let me make a note. Just to give you an idea of an application. But here's an everyday example. I recently raised a hatching of wild ducks, mallards, in a pen that I constructed at my ranch. The pen was necessary to protect them from critters until they're old enough to fend for themselves and flee danger by flying, especially since I'm there only on weekends. This necessitated living in the pen, partly submerged in the water at the edge of the lake, so they could learn to swim and develop naturally for about 5 weeks. When I opened the gate of the pen, they wouldn't leave. Despite their freedom to swim in a beautiful lake or just fly away, confinement in this small pen had become a comfort zone. I had to force them out, literally pick up the pen and tump them out. Then, as soon as they were all released, all 12 moved as a group, never more than a few inches apart, a habit they formed in the pen. They continued to fly and swim in this tight pattern for a very long time. Now, think about your attachment patterns, the default behaviors of your relationships with important people. Some may have been etched early on with essential people in your life. Even though it's a default mode, even though you've incorporated it as a model, perhaps even use it with your children or spouse, it's still a choice. You can choose to continue or choose another pattern, another habit. Just because you have a history with someone doesn't mean you have to keep repeating it. An example. I worked with the CEO of a successful company that he founded. His son had a condition that if he took medication, he would remain without symptoms. He had bipolar disorder. And the son at the time was about 30 years old and was a PhD. He had just been hospitalized again and lost his teaching position at a university. My client was about to repeat the pattern he had engaged in 6 times before in the last decade and a half when his son was in crisis to rescue him. He would basically move to the city where his son was hospitalized and spend at least 2 or 3 months disrupting his life and his business. So he had orchestrated the equivalent of several midnight helicopter rescues from a Mexican prison, basically. And as I questioned him, he acknowledged that his efforts made no difference, yet he kept doing the same thing. He was enhancing his sense of helplessness that by now had affected both his health and the effectiveness of running his company by focusing on what he could not determine, not on what he could. So, in order to establish a new attachment pattern with his son, I first recommended that he and his wife attend CODA meetings for support, Codependents Anonymous, for people who have loved ones who will not take care of themselves. This was one of the most loving dads I know, so this was really difficult for him. And I recommended something very counterintuitive for him, that he stop rescuing his son and indicate to his son that he believed in him and that he would be there after the hospitalization if he wanted to visit. So basically, my client let go and supported his son in a very different way than he had before. Now, fast forward. His son, for the last 5 years, has been symptom-free, hospital-free. He takes his meds consistently. For the first time in his adult life, he has a faculty position and has started a family. Now, a fundamental precept of step 2, own your story. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Now, to be fair about that, let me add, in adulthood, whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Now, let's apply that by talking about first point of reference. A point of reference is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. Their theme can include passivity or resignation. Their experience is helplessness. They transfer responsibility to somebody or something outside themselves. They react to situations they're in. Here's some typical characteristics of someone with an external point of reference. And again, every one of these, in my view, is a coachable moment. They feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. They're vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than creating. Well, I have to do this. They see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. They believe they can only change things by changing the outside source or person. If they experience a symptom in their bodies, they may medicate it away. That's like seeing a warning light on the dash of your car and disconnecting it rather than pursuing the problem, disconnecting the light. Now, contrast that. Those with an internal point of reference, and this is what we coach toward with someone. Someone with an internal point of reference see their authority as their own. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility. Their theme is effectiveness. They know that at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. And here are some of their characteristics. They recognize accountability for their own lives. They are proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated that result, then look for alternatives. If they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. They decide what to change and initiate that change. And they realize that the menu of choices is also created. You can choose and you can choose how you choose. Now, a related notion is to recognize active versus passive positions. And this is something that you can listen for in your client, how that client constructs a sentence. Let me give you some examples. I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. My thoughts run away from me. It just seems to keep happening. You have to eliminate all the outs. Remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. These passive positions disown the feelings, thoughts, or actions as an active creation. It's as if the feeling that you create makes you its victim. To say, my doubt stopped me or my anxiety paralyzed me. The feeling that you create, you see as if it were acting on you and making you its victim rather than you're the author of that experience or that feeling. So this passivity can mask personal initiative. So rather than managing, overcoming, countering, or medicating a feeling, the first step is to acknowledge that even though it may seem to just happen, you generate the experience. Then you can examine the meaning you attach. Insight and understanding alone do not generate a positive, successful news story. You have to create it. So, once recognizing and owning your story, steps one and two, steps three, assess the storyline and plot. A belief or fact is an anatomical reality in the brain. It's a physical part of a neuronal network. And think about the importance of that. A belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in the brain. A teacher can't present a simple explanation and remove an existing neural network from a student's brain. You can't just list a reason that an idea is good and expect someone's going to suddenly have that overwrite what's in their brain already, or they'll rearrange their neural network and pathways. But change can occur. It's a process, though, and not an event. It's an inside job. This step is to assess beliefs to see if they're limiting in order to try out new beliefs. What's another way to look at this? How might my thoughts be limiting me? Who has a different perspective on this? Are there questions I'm afraid to ask? And at some level, you know what they are. Remember, denial is a powerful engagement, just like a secret. What do I really want? What do I need to let go of? I want to highlight, especially in your workbook, beginning page 1.17, the needs and ideals. These are the two exercises that with almost every client I began with, I recommend that they do the needs and the ideals exercise and send me their top three needs and top three ideals. And I put them inside the folder for that client so that as we're working, I can keep their needs and ideals in mind and be sure that they align with strategies and with goals. And often having their needs and ideals in clear focus is very, very helpful for the client. Ideals, basically, are internal standards of excellence. They serve as a personal model of value, a kind of an internal guide to purpose. Living up to a personal attainable ideal generates a sense of worth and self-esteem. In fact, the only place that I know that self-esteem comes from is from having internal ideals and living up to them. And contrast that. The failure to live up to an internal ideal results in a feeling of shame. So now a need is an essential requirement. It's a necessity for mind, body, and spirit. An unmet need is the gap between an internal standard and reality, a gap between our blueprint of the way things ought to be and our life experience. So here's a vignette that illustrates work to clarify needs and ideals and align them with goals. And notice how we can learn just from someone's language and behavior the assumptions that drive their stories. My client said, I feel like I've been cheated at the end of the day. It's 9 o'clock at night and I haven't even eaten yet. The way my schedule goes is that I come home from work and my wife hands our son to me. So I'm in charge of him from 5 to 7. Son was, I think, between 18 and 20 months at that time. I love that, but I'm tired. She uses that time to do her computer work. Then I finish work from the day, and it's at least 9 o'clock. I'm stressed out. I highlighted two aspects of what he said. I've been cheated the way my schedule is. I pointed out that he was speaking as if he were not writing his own story, as if it were ghostwritten by someone else and not even approved by him. I knew he was in charge of his own schedule. Then I asked him simply, why are you writing your daily story in a way that you don't like, do you think? He paused. He was kind of dumbfounded. He said, well, I guess I feel like I have to. I feel like I have to support my wife and take care of our son in that way. My work just spills into the evening into my private life, so I don't even work out or relax. I even have to take calls from my people during the time with my son. Something is assumed and expected of me when I walk in the door. I feel like someone else is in control of me. And I said, what do you hear yourself say? And he thought for just a moment. He said, somebody else is writing my story for me. And I said, you're not acting like you own your story or your company. He said, how can I protect the time with my son? I said, every yes you have to pay for with at least one no. Those yeses are getting really expensive. No protected time to be totally with him, for him and you. No total immersion in free play. I said, let's start at the beginning. Assume every day is a blank page, and there's nothing on it until you write it. How ideally would you like your day to be? Well, he went through the day and structured it proactively, clustered activities that required the same state of mind, didn't let his managers or people from his executive team interrupt him whenever they decided. He decided to put that to a certain time period in the day. And he said, then I'd like to use my time after work for my family and to relax. Then he completed the structure. He even worked in, at my nudging, exercise. And I said, I hear you beginning to write a different story to take care of yourself. It's a powerful model for your son, for him to see fully how a man can take care of himself and others. Now, when he was really getting it and reflecting on what we were saying and putting this into play and mentioning how incredibly more effective he was being in running his company, I said, I want to share a hunch to see if it's useful for us to consider. I suspect the frustrations that you haven't spoken about until now, about your company, your marriage, are there at a subliminal level and get communicated so others feel it, your wife, your employees, your customers. I'd guess it registers as something not working quite right, and you or they don't know exactly why until it lights on something that makes it make sense, even though it's not the real cause. He responded immediately. He said, yeah, like when I blow up or fire somebody. I said, that would end the tension for a little while. He said, yeah, and then I'm off to the races again. He recognized that when he structured a way to meet his own needs to take care of the foundation of his wellness, that he was creating a personal and professional mastery. By having clear boundaries, he could be totally immersed in work during the day, totally free at home. Both were restorative for him and for his family. Another aspect. Part of the assessment of a story is to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. with the right map, planning, and strategy can make a huge difference. We each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We're often not aware of having them, but we just assume that we see things the way they are. There's some recent studies in neuroscience that show that this is exactly the way that our brains operate, like a Google map, that when we see a situation, we boot up a mindset to deal with that situation. So when we see another situation, we boot up another mindset to deal with that situation. So the important thing then is to have the continuity among the different mindsets, to have a continuous story that is cohesive and that's grounded in one's sense of identity based on needs, ideals, and strategy and goals. Now, here's an example of something that I think you'll each see in coaching with clients and see it essentially with every client in some form or another. Whenever someone begins a new experience and begins the process of change, there is always, with that change, a sense of anxiety or uncertainty or trepidation, simply because when we change the way we're doing things, we enter new territory, and that new territory is not familiar to us. We leave a comfort zone and the familiarity of the repetition of the old story to try something new. Now, it literally in the brain is like leaving the superhighway of the familiar to try out something different, to take a machete into, you know, uncharted territory and make our way, and it's uncomfortable. And the quickest way to restore that balance, that comfort, is to get back on the superhighway, to go back to the way things were before. Even though that may not go exactly where you want it to, it's certainly easier and less energy to travel that way. So, one thing that we need to do with our clients is to help them understand this process, because when they begin to try something new, they may read it as, well, you know, my discomfort is greater here. I don't think this is the right way to go. Or my intuition is telling me that this isn't right. My gut's registering that. Now, what we need to do is to distinguish intuition and gut responses. And those are all valid, but that's a misread of this experience. Whenever somebody tries out something new and goes through a change that they haven't done before, there's going to be discomfort that's generated. So they can understand that as part of a validation that they're moving ahead, a signpost that they're in new territory and is an expectable experience of what they're doing. If they read that experience, say anxiety, in an old model, as in anxiety equals danger, better head for cover, then they would retreat from that. Now, one thing that we'll look at again when we get to the P of the roadmap, program new identity, the most common force of the human psyche is to return to our core identity. And the way we usually do things has been incorporated as part of our identity. So when a client does something different or new and makes a change, we need to help them not only understand that in a new model in order to accept and find validation in the discomfort, but also to incorporate that as part of an evolving transformation of how they see themselves, so that their core identity incorporates that change and their identity changes along with their surface story. This is what makes change last. This is what makes it permanent. Here's another example. We need to be afraid of the right thing. We're afraid of what's readily remembered, the recency effect, because it happened recently, there was an emotional charge, we remember it better. And we fear what we can't control. For example, it's a lot more dangerous to be behind the wheel of a car, but in airplane seat 18C, we feel no control, so we focus on that. Another, smokers who are afraid of flying. Averaged across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Averaged across all participants, flying shortens their lives by 1 day. people fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime more than food entering their bodies that may clog arteries and cause heart attacks. One of the unique qualities that we have as human beings is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means that we can learn from our experiences and from others' experiences as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things and reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. And it's more difficult for someone to change if they describe a habit, a collection of repetitions, as if it were their identity. Well, that's just the way I am. That also is something I would challenge in terms of a coachable moment. One other thing I want to talk about. To listen to your self-statements. And in the back of the curriculum, there's a glossary, and look at the self-statement description there. It might give you a better idea. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. Whatever you attribute to others, another person, a group, a culture, comes from inside you as a self-statement. It's a projection onto that other person or thing or entity. We always perceive and create outside to match inside. So pay attention to what you consistently like and dislike in another. Don't project your intentions onto someone else's behavior. Acknowledge and own every aspect about yourself. Take yourself very personally. Listen carefully and explicitly to all the messages from your interior, to your whole truth. Feelings never lie. The body cannot deceive. If you want to find out what you believe about yourself and the world, look around at your life. It's the self-statement, the mirror of what exists inside you. When you feel preoccupied or disrupted internally, you'll notice that your house or office or car reflects that experience. All that you say and do in the syntax of thought, feeling, and behavior is about yourself. And this is important in coaching. Remember, too, everyone else also makes self-statements. What you say about me doesn't tell me about me. It tells me about you. What someone says about you has everything to do with the speaker, even though it's highly focused on you. Listen, take in new information, but don't take it personally. Now, in actuality, only a theory is ever this simple and clear. But all others can do is share their experience of you. It is their experience and perception, their point of view. You can share your experience of someone else, but be aware that your perceptions are also filtered through your lens. For example, if someone's being critical and judgmental of you, it's your decision whether to believe and accept that point of view. Consider if you're assigning an aspect of yourself to someone else. If you believe you lack a certain quality, you may focus on someone who exhibits it. This reliance on someone functioning for you or on an external point of reference for validation can be limiting. In order to grow, we have to move our point of reference to an internal one and own responsibility and accountability for every aspect of our life and its expression. Another aspect of this, listen for repetitions of the old story. We each generate a life story with a recurring plot. We repeat its continuing formula over time, even if it's not a winning one. Each repetition may more deeply reinforce basic assumptions and perhaps a belief that you're a victim of fate. Remember this. Whatever remains unconscious is likely to be attributed to fate. To re-enter an old story and attempt a better ending creates a variation of the scenario, a new edition of the same process. The more you run away from something, the more you engage it. and the more apparent it becomes. Sometimes you can recognize something the first time only by denying it. At times, we repeat just to see in relation to a fixed point of reference how much we've changed. Each time we return to the chorus of the song, the repetition is satisfying, but the same words are different because more of the lyrical story has unfolded, and we see more of the evolving journey at each juncture of repetition. This is something I think is important, and we'll come back to this as well. One thing that I believe is important in working with clients is to validate their progress, to look at the process of where they are now in terms of where they've been and where they're going, because that will be always evolving and ever-changing. And this ability to self-reflect, to look at themselves, will be internalized so that ultimately they won't need you in order to do it. And this is a premier quality of someone to be able to self-reflect. In fact, there were a couple of articles in a recent Harvard Business Review and Scientific American Mind about self-reflection being the primary quality of a successful CEO. And remember this, you're always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or not. If your personal or professional life is not as gratifying as you like, if you believe you haven't attained your objectives, look more closely. It's helpful to know consciously and specifically what those goals are. You might be undermining your success by being too vague in your objectives. Do you fear specifically yet dream vaguely? And to each of you, for example, do you have a business plan for your coaching practice? Another example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self, for example, of overweight or out of shape. Then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. Listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you're going to try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying immediately says it's not a full commitment. It's a potential diversion to other alternatives against failure. Now, you think about this. You know the words of someone who's not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction, by not being totally committed, by creating an out. When somebody says, I'm going to try to stop drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. I will. And this is something that you want to get to at the end of the coaching session when you ask for the client's commitment for what they will get done before you meet again, to look at a commitment. And I will, not I'm going to try. And as coaches, we build in accountability by asking by when. Our SMART goals wouldn't have a T on the end. And finally, listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. When you listen to whispers, no one has to shout. You sense it and feel it when you eat healthily, work out, rest well, at the time and especially later. We'll return to this in Module 10 on wellness, but here's the prologue. Listen to somatic language, to the message in each pain, discomfort, dis-ease, change of function, exhilaration, sensation, energy spurt. There are no accidents within the system. The story of your body. As with any complex system, a change of one component affects every aspect of that system. Of your body's 11 systems, only two have memory, the nervous and immune. A new story involving your body inscribes a new text for these two systems and benefits your whole body. So here's a final thought, a recommendation, actually, of two brainstorming sessions to schedule an appointment with yourself for each. And here are the prompts. Everyone on Earth has one thing in common. Our choices in life define us. Those who provide service to others, such as authors, money managers, therapists, leaders, teachers, coaches, especially parents, have their answers counted many times. What will yours be? Make it matter. Your thoughts or questions or reflections? I'm interested
I didn't really get what the question was for the last one. You said everyone on Earth has one thing. What was the question?
Okay, let me do that again. Two brainstorming, so two appointments with yourself. One is to meditate, and one is to brainstorm, because those are two different states of there are two different states of mind entirely. And here's the prompt for the brainstorm. People have their answers counted many times. What will yours be? Your choices in life define you. How will your story be? Make sense? Yeah, other thoughts or questions?
You said that when someone comes, for instance, to me and say something that she felt about me, am I waking in that person a perception of herself? Am I being like a mirror?
There's a kind of an echo, and I'm having trouble hearing. Would you say that again, please?
For example, when someone comes to me and tells me something that she perceived about myself, and you said not to take this as a projection, or to recognize that as a projection and not take it personally. But what made that person come to me and say the things that she said? Is that person projecting in myself something that is in herself?
Yes. So here's the point of that. You would never want to disregard that, and you want to listen to see if there's something that you can take away that's important. But what you will hear is a playing out of an attachment pattern. The way that a client relates to you will tell you information about that client. And the important point is to not take it personally, because that would keep you from looking at the process for the information that it will tell you about that client.
Okay.
So that they're going to, and in fact, the paper that I'm going to send you on attachment patterns will give you some examples of that. There's another example at my blog archived. My blog on my website is mentorpath.com/blog, and the blog articles are archived on the right. And there's a blog called "We're Always Teaching Others," and that's an example of what I'm talking about now, about how our clients are always teaching us exactly what it's like to be them. So, if, for example, you're perceiving something about a client, take that as an accurate barometer of what that client is showing you about what it's like to be that client. Whatever the client is manifesting with you is the very best job they can do to show you what it's like to be them, so they can get some help in creating something different. You have a certain sensation or a feeling with a client. Rather than trying to squash that feeling or disregard it and move on and refocus on the client, consider it as an accurate barometer of what that client is experiencing at that moment, because the client's trying to teach you, but they don't have the conscious awareness, perhaps, They don't have the words or language to convey it to you, but they're conveying it to you in the process and your empathic resonance. This is a midbrain to midbrain communication. And if you listen to it, if you experience it as accurate as coming from the client, I think you'll find it a real benefit in working with a client. Look at that blog and look at the paper I'm going to send you and see if that makes it make more sense, because I think it can be really helpful. This is one of the benefits that as you go through this training, you're going to be some of the few coaches in the world who really incorporate the mind and the brain sciences in terms of working with clients. And this is an example of that, because this is the contagion of emotion and the contagion of a state of mind that can be very helpful, not to be dismissed or disregarded in any way, but taken as vital information of the process. You know, we're usually taught as coaches to focus on the content, to look at goals and strategies and all of that. This is something different. This is focusing on the process of what transpires between you and your client and making use of that and taking that in as information that can be valuable and crucial in the work. Let me give you another example. Let's say you referred the CEO of a company, and the CEO was referred by a board of directors because the CEO has managed to alienate everybody in the executive suite, has a style that's really annoying, that manages to alienate and create an adversarial relationship. And the board of directors, and this is a true story, the board of directors got together, confronted this person, and said, we need you to do mentor coaching in order to address this, to see if this can be remedied and we can do a turnaround here within the executive suite. So this guy comes to me, and very soon, guess what? He begins to annoy me. And I know that this is exactly what he does with other people in the executive suite. He's showing me exactly what it's like to be him. Now, what I have to do is to create a working alliance with him. The very first thing that we do as coaches is to develop a working alliance with our clients so that we will be able to say anything and everything to them. That's another blog so that we can say exactly what we need to say to them to help them in a collaborative mode to address the self-reflection and the process of change that they need. But that's information. If I take it in a different way to say, well, he's trying to annoy me, he's trying to defeat me, just like he tried to defeat the board, that wouldn't help, and that would result in the same impasse that he's experiencing at his corporation. If I take it as this is information, and this tells me about an attachment pattern, a certain kind of behavioral pattern that he has with important people that isn't working for him and is creating an adversarial relationship and ineffectiveness on his part, if I can create a working alliance with him, then we have the possibility of reversing that and creating attachment patterns that do work. So I know that I'm the only person in the world who can get away with saying to him what I need to say in order for us to consider this. But I also know I need to say it in a collaborative way, in an empathic way, so that it just doesn't, you know, upset him. And he says, so long, I'm not interested in this. So that's another kind of example of what I'm talking about. Does that make sense to you?
What was an attachment pattern?
Say it again, please.
What was his attachment pattern for that behavior?
Well, it was to be condescending, to elevate himself, to feel like, to basically counter
the
sense of ineffectiveness and a sense of a somewhat lack of worth and being afraid that he was going to be revealed to be a fraud by pushing people away and acting in a way that would be off-putting to people so that they would feel that they needed to keep coming back and trying harder and that it was their fault.
But you think that's kind of how he was raised? Maybe that's why the patterns are?
Yeah, it didn't matter how he was raised or
didn't
where
matter.
It came from.
Okay.
It mattered that he was doing it now. Yeah, he came to see and reflect on that, and it was interesting to see him historically, but we didn't get lost in the history of it because this wasn't therapy or analysis. This was about the choice architecture of this moment and of looking at how he could understand that and what he did, what was the experience, what was the state of mind, first of all, that created that experience. Because confidence is a state of mind, lack of confidence is a state of mind, that then he could get centered and grounded and stay regulated and create a very different scenario. Are there other thoughts or questions?
So you're trying to keep everything in the present moment, like now, don't go back.
Right.
How you're acting now, yeah.
Yeah, whatever, you know, all the experiences that go into this moment, you know, thoughts, feelings, experiences, everything is important. And it's not to avoid feelings, but it's to focus on this moment and the choices that are made at this moment to look at choices made in terms of goals and choices to see if they're working or not. And to see what the choices are in terms of the goals and strategies and in terms of needs and ideals. And remember the case of the guy who owned his company. His needs were not being met because he was meeting other people's needs because he thought that that was what was going to be getting him ahead in his business, which it wasn't. It was the antithesis of that. And he was not living up to his own ideal to take care of himself and his family by letting these things erode that and to lose his focus on that. So when we looked at needs and ideals in light of strategies and goals, all of him could be going in the same direction. And that could inform his choices and create strategies that would have him writing his story, even including the structure of his day, hour by hour, and how much that impacted his own experience and his own effectiveness. Well, I will send you what I mentioned, and we will pick up right here next time. My apologies about the...
Are we going to go over the ideal and needs decision tree, like the ideal need goal commitment? Are we going to go like practicing that, or we just reuse it?
What I would recommend is that each of you do those exercises yourself to look at your top three needs and your top three ideals, and to use that in your planning. So that's why I emphasize especially doing those exercises for yourself.
Okay.
Okay, well, thanks very much. We'll pick up right here next time.
Okay, thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Thank you very much.